My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big ROAS man. Then he just kept saying things like, the bigger the ROAS, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means calculating a return on ad spend. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the ROAS man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/customer to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/customer. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
The 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, is finally here.
With the first pick in the NFL Draft.
Catch all 7 rounds, 3 days, live from Detroit.
They're looking to get a guy that they believe can change the game.
With NFL Network Draft coverage presented by Verizon and on ABC, ESPN, ESPN Deportes, and streaming on NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/draft for more information. Presented by Bud Light. Easy to drink, easy to enjoy.
You're listening to Math and Magic, a production of iHeartRadio.
It doesn't matter what you've already done. What matters more is what you can learn to do. Skills are variable in a way that passion is not. I have consistently found that following my passion and being willing to reinvent myself and learn new things takes me to places where I'm happier and able to do more than I ever thought I could.
Hi, I'm Bob Pittman, and welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. Businesses and industries grow from bold steps and from ignoring conventional wisdom and herd mentality. Our guest today embodies all that. He's taking commercial aviation back into supersonic flight. He is the founder and CEO of Boom Supersonic, Blake Scholl. Blake is a pilot with a lifelong fascination with aviation. He describes himself as having been a socially awkward child, but clearly a smart one. He loves summer science camps and even started a web hosting and consulting business while in high school. He skipped his last year of high school and started college early, went on to Amazon, tech startups, and Groupon before he took matters into his own hands and followed his passions and his dreams to start Boom Supersonic. Now, I have to disclose as we began that I've been a pilot since I was 16. I have 7,000 hours of flight time, have an airline transport pilot's license, and until the pandemic hit, when I skipped flight school for a few years, I flew left seat in a Falcon 900 for the last 20 years, as well as a helicopter. I'm a former board member of the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum and basically love everything about airplanes and flying. I'm a plane geek. As you can imagine, I'm really excited to spend this episode with Blake. Blake, welcome.
Great to be here, Bob. I guess you and I are both plane crazy.
Thank goodness. Blake, before we dig into the meat, I'd like to put you in perspective with a little feature we do called You in 60 Seconds. Ready?
Let's do it.
Do you prefer cats or dogs?
Dogs.
Cincinnati or Denver?
Denver, definitely.
Introvert or extrovert?
Introvert who plays an extrovert on TV.
Window or aisle?
If it's a long flight, I'll take aisle. If it's a shorter flight, prefer the window.
Amazon or Groupon?
Definitely Amazon.
Pilot or passenger?
Pilot all day long.
Video games or board games?
Board games.
Arctic or desert?
Desert.
Virgin Galactic or SpaceX?
SpaceX, hands down.
X-15 or X-1?
Let's go X-1.
Moon or Mars?
Definitely the moon.
Favorite astronaut?
Neil Armstrong.
Secret talent?
I don't know, dad jokes.
Except for Boom, your favorite plane?
The SR-71 Blackbird.
Smartest person you know.
Jeff Bezos.
Childhood hero.
Bill Gates.
Okay, final one. Most exciting airport where you've landed yourself.
My best, most exciting, maybe not proudest landing story was at Mimelusse, Oregon.
Wow. Let's jump in and start with a history lesson. I used to take the Concorde when it had regular service to London and Paris. I could wake up in Paris, have breakfast, leisurely get to the airport for a noon departure, and land in New York 3 hours earlier at 9 a.m. Truly magic. I have taken two of my three kids on the Concorde, and then before my youngest could make her flight, it stopped. Can you tell us why Concorde stopped and maybe why it never really had a real business plan?
My view is Concorde was stillborn. If we start at the surface level, it shut down because it was too expensive to fly relative to the passenger demand. A ticket on Concorde, adjusted inflation, you know, today it's upward of $20,000. And yet 100 not necessarily very comfortable seats on the airplane to fill. And it's just very difficult to find 100 people who want to spend 20 grand to go somewhere really fast. So even on the most popular routes, like the ones you're mentioning, New York, London, New York, Paris, the airplane was typically half empty. And it did not have the, you know, the economics or the range to achieve economies of scale. So why did that happen? In my view, the deepest cause here is that this was a Cold War era glory project. This was not a commercial venture. Concorde was established in 1962 via treaty between the French and British governments. And the goal was really, you know, fly fast, try not to crash, and show up the Russians. And it was, at that level, mission accomplished. But it was never something that was designed to be commercially successful or commercially viable. Very much akin to Apollo. And in fact, in 1969, first moon landing, first Concorde flight. Neither of those had any sort of thought of economics or commercial viability. And while they both looked like tremendous technological progress, you know, as we sit here, if you want a lunar lander or a supersonic airliner, we got to go to a museum, not look up into the skies. And I think that goes back to the importance of commercial consideration on day zero and doing things for national prestige. Yeah, we can show up the Russians, but it's not really a bridge to changing the world.
So let's give people who don't know much about Concorde a little lesson. It flew Mach 2.0, that's about 1,300 miles per hour. It flew up to 60,000 feet. You could see sort of the curvature of the Earth up there. And it was a small cabin. The galley was in the middle, so there was a front and a back, but it wasn't first class and coach or business. And it got incredibly warm in that cabin, especially around the galley as you were flying it. What else should they know about Concorde?
Yeah, I think that's all about right. It was a long, skinny airplane, a triangular delta wing, and expensive to fly, and also a first impression of smallness. The boarding door was small. You have to duck to get in. And then before you even get to the passenger cabin, there's the equivalent of maybe three or four rows of seats worth of, you know, kind of Florida ceiling equipment racks. And so it had sort of a first impression of a really tight space before you even get back into the passenger cabin.
And today you can see Concorde. There's one at the Intrepid Museum on the Hudson River in New York, and there's one at the Air and Space Museum out at Dulles Airport in D.C. So why did the airlines and consumers lose interest in supersonic, or did they?
I think there's always been tremendous consumer excitement in supersonic. The problem was that it wasn't offered at a price or an experience or with a route network that made it make sense. And so $20,000 round trip New York to London, for most people, that's a bucket list item. It's not transportation. And if we look back at, you know, what happened when we went in the 50s and 60s from props to jets, there has always been consumer interest in more speed. And when more speed is offered at a price point and in locations that people can really afford, it changes where we do business, it changes where we vacation, it even changes who we can fall in love with. But supersonic flight, you know, really only offered on one airplane and never offered at a price point that was attainable to any other than a, you know, a relatively small number of people.
So let's go to the big question. Why will you succeed when the others failed?
Well, it's certainly not guaranteed that we'll succeed. There's a lot of challenge ahead of us. Fortunately, there's also some challenge in the rearview mirror. I can talk about why I think the time is right and why if Boom doesn't succeed, it'll be our failure of execution, not a failure of opportunity. You know, 50 years after Concorde was designed, we've had both significant progress in basic airplane technology and huge growth in the market. So imagine, you know, Concorde, $20,000 ticket. If airlines were charging a quarter of that, say like $5,000 on our airplane on Overture, it'd be incredibly profitable. And it has the legs not just to do a couple of headline routes, but it's economically viable on hundreds. So, you know, not just New York, London, but Seattle to Tokyo and LA to Sydney and Miami to Madrid, just to give a few examples. And we're able to go build that airplane using only technologies that have been proven safe, reliable, and efficient. So from a technological perspective, this is at the same level as a Boeing 787, meaning it's a carbon fiber composite fuselage. It's got advanced turbofan engines, fly-by-wire flight controls. We could keep nerding out about it. Every single thing on the airplane has a precedent of flying on other commercial airplanes and being accepted as safe by regulators around the planet.
So your range is about twice what Concorde was?
Not quite twice. It's 4,250 nautical miles or about 5,000 statute miles. And that's with all the seats filled and everyone checking a big heavy bag. And you know, Concorde was 3,000 and change. So we've got not quite 50% more range. However, with 65 seats on the airplane and the operating cost and overall efficiency being better, routes like LA-Sydney, that's a very long route. So today that's a 14, 15-hour flight with Overture. It's about 8.5 hours, including stopping in Tahiti for gas.
Wow, that's great. And the speed is 2.0 like Concorde?
Slightly slower, actually. Mach 1.7. We initially aimed to be a little bit faster, but as we learn more about the details, what we found was going very slightly slower generated significantly better economics, significantly better sustainability, and also allowed us to reduce the technological challenge, for example, by being able to operate within proven material systems.
That is, I guess, always the question is speed versus range, but it sounds like you still got a lot of speed.
There'll be an Overture too. And our goal is to make it significantly faster. As an airplane nerd, I get very excited about that stuff. But as a passenger, I want to put this airplane in the hands of airlines and passengers as quickly as possible. And so a phrase that got drilled into me kind of growing up in tech, growing up in Silicon Valley, was minimum viable product. And Overture 1 is really a minimum viable supersonic airplane. We've kept it as small and simple as we can because we want to get it out as quickly as possible.
I want to dig into some questions about the how, and probably more importantly for this podcast, the management lessons you learn. But first, I want to get some perspective on you by going back to your childhood. You grew up in Cincinnati. Your dad was an engineer. Your mom was a French teacher. Paint the picture of growing up in the Midwest in the 80s and 90s.
I was an only kid, so I sort of grew up by myself, didn't have a lot of friends, and I spent a lot of time playing on my own, thinking on my own. I was obsessed with model trains throughout much of my childhood. And as I got a little bit older, you know, became obsessed with computers. And I love that gratification cycle of how easy it was to do something in software and be able to see a result quickly. I remember thinking about airplanes and wanting to learn to fly, you know, drawing little pictures of, you know, cartoon airplanes that I dream of building.
So where did the love of airplanes come from? There must have been someone who planted that seed in there for you.
If you believe my parents, it goes back to when I was 6 months old, and they had taken me to this little airport in suburban Cincinnati to watch the Cessnas take off and land. And I had a little Fisher-Price toy airplane. As they tell the story, that was the first time I made the connection between a toy thing and a real thing. And I just lit up. So I don't know, maybe it imprinted somehow. But as long as I can remember, like, I found flight inspiring. And it is such a uniquely human thing to be able to do. I mean, we weren't born to fly. We're far heavier than air, and we don't have wings like birds. We had to go invent the airplane. And, you know, to this day, looking down out the window, it's a uniquely human vantage point where we can take in everything that we've built as humanity, as well as the natural beauty of the world, and doing it aboard one of the most complex safety critical machines ever created. It's like we're riding on the, you know, the wings of Newton and the Wright brothers. You're looking down on the creation of, you know, Edison and Rockefeller and Ford. And it's just an incredibly unique thing and an incredibly human thing.
More on math and magic right after this quick break.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big ROAS man. Then he just kept saying things like, the bigger the ROAS, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means calculating a return on ad spend. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the ROAS man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/customer to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/customer. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Welcome back to Math and Magic. Let's hear more from my conversation with Blake Shaw. So you have said you were a socially awkward kid. How did that contribute to your later success?
Bob, that's not a question I think I've ever been asked before. It's really thought-provoking. I have vivid memories of sitting by myself, like in elementary school, just thinking. And I remember being told, I think in first grade, that we couldn't fly faster than the speed of light. And that didn't make any sense to me. And I remember sitting by myself at recess in elementary school thinking about how we could fly faster than the speed of light. I didn't understand anything about aerospace or physics or rockets. And so I didn't know that rockets were, you know, not empty on the inside. And I remember those like Russian dolls that are nested. You know, you take one apart, and then there's like another doll on the inside. You take it apart, there's one on the inside. Like, I remember thinking about, like, well, couldn't you build a rocket like that? And it'd be like one nested inside the next, nested inside the next. And, you know, it seemed like if we had a contraption like that, well, couldn't you go arbitrarily fast? And I look back now, and it's like, you know, not only did I not understand physics and relativity, like, I didn't understand that rockets, they had stuff on the inside. There was not like they were empty. You could put another rocket in there. So it was incredibly naive. But I spent a lot of time, because I guess I didn't have friends, just kind of by myself thinking.
So let's talk about science camps. What's the power of a science camp? What did they mean to you?
The single biggest thing I think it meant to me was a chance to see what a good education could actually be like, how engaging it could be, and how fun it was to be around other kids that I considered my peers. Like, I did not like school growing up. I was bored, was not engaging. I'm so grateful to mom and dad. And mom researched all this back when there was no internet and she had to go to the public library to kind of figure out what was out there. But she sent me to, you know, programming camps and electrical engineering camps and various, today we call it STEM type stuff. And I loved it. It was a chance to be challenged, a chance to learn. The teaching was great. And I got to hang out with other kids that were like me that I just didn't really have in suburban Cincinnati public school kind of environment.
So tell us the story of how you skipped your last year of high school, got a scholarship to Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
So went to public high school in suburban Cincinnati, did not love it, felt mostly socially disconnected, felt mostly academically disconnected. And my high school girlfriend was a grade ahead of me. So she was going to exit high school a year before I was. And I think she said, like, hey, you should figure out how to do that too. And on my short list of schools that were my, you know, dream schools was Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. And it turned out they had this, in my view, brilliant program where you could apply as a junior, basically write an essay about why high school sucks and there's nothing left for you there. Then they would run you through an interview, which I think was basically a maturity test. And if you passed the maturity test and they liked your essay, they would just treat you like you're a high school senior. And they let me come be a freshman without ever finishing high school, without ever getting a GED. And I was like every other freshman on campus. I look backwards and it was one of the best things I've ever done.
And obviously you did well at university.
I did all right. I also rushed through. I did my undergrad in 3 years, but I did actually graduate that time.
So you dropped out of high school, sold your high school era business, and off you went to college. And there, I think you took your first flying lesson. 2008, you got your private pilot's license. 2011, you got your instrument rating. Do you still fly today? And what do you fly?
Yeah, I still fly today. All my time recently is in a Cirrus SR-22T, which for the folks who don't know is, it's basically the, in my opinion, the best single engine airplane you can get today. So it's a 4 or 5 seat airplane, single engine propeller, has the legs to go maybe it tops 1,000 miles, but it's a real nice little airplane, great for kind of regional trips.
And for the layman, sounds really exciting. It has a parachute, right?
It does. If something goes really badly wrong, there's a handle that you can pull and a rocket fires out the back of the airplane. And a parachute rapidly inflates and the entire airplane just floats to the ground. And this has saved dozens, if not, it's probably approaching 100 lives now that have been saved through the ballistic parachutes, as they call them. In fact, one of the Cirruses based here in Centennial that I used to fly was in a mid-air collision about a year ago. And typically mid-air collisions, it's like everybody dies. It's really bad. And in this case, the Cirrus was able to pull the parachute. Miraculously, the airplane it collided with landed straight ahead and was fine. It was really a miracle day where everyone lived, in part because of the parachute on the Cirrus.
After college, you started as a software engineer at Amazon in 2001. You left in 2007. What lessons did you learn at Amazon that you still use today?
We could probably talk for hours and not days on things I learned at Amazon. One of them was something that Jeff would just drill into everyone's mind, which was if you wanted to build something enduring, don't focus on what's new and trendy. Focus on what's going to stay the same over a long period of time. In the context of Amazon, he would talk about selection and availability and price as being things that people would always care about, and therefore being things where you could make significant investments over a period of decades and trust that you're going to be creating something of value. You know, that thinking directly applies to Boom because, you know, people are going to always want flights that are faster and more affordable and more convenient. And those are vectors in which we can invest over a period of decades to build something great. Another one that comes to mind was this notion of individuals and companies doing things that they didn't have the resume for. You know, so when I joined Amazon, it was always a debate, is it a bookstore or is it a software company? And I got to be there. I didn't work directly on it, but I got to be there when they built AWS. And I got to be there when they built Kindle. And Amazon, the retailer slash software company, didn't have the resume to do any of those things. And yet they did. They figured it out. And that left me with sort of the very distinct impression that it doesn't matter what you've already done. What matters more is what you can learn to do. Skills are variable in a way that passion is not. And so I have consistently found that following my passion and being willing to reinvent myself and learn new things takes me to places where I'm happier and able to do more than I ever thought I could.
You did a couple of tech startups, and in 2012, you were acquired by Groupon. Could not have been a hotter company at the time. A couple of questions. What did you do there? What did you learn? And why did Groupon lose its mojo?
To set the stage here a little bit, so it was 2012. I had founded my first company. It was called Kima Labs. And I look back, and that was really a case study in everything not to do. But it was 2012. The valley was hot. And if you had a decent team, you could basically sell it for team and technology. And so Groupon bought my startup for team and technology. And they put me on what, in my view, should have been Groupon 2.0. And so if you think back about the foundation of Groupon with the local coupons, there were so many at that time business plans that were pitched that were about reinventing how we transact with a local business, but they all had a chicken and egg problem because they needed a digital connection to local businesses and they needed a digital connection to consumers. Groupon cracked the chicken and egg problem, you know, basically with a viral coupon. The company was super hot, but Andrew Mason, who was basically the founding CEO, had a really compelling vision about how to take that collection of chickens and eggs and parlay it into something really inspiring and really great that was about reinventing the way we would transact at a local business. So they bought my company, and then we went off and we bought another company that was a iPad-based point-of-sale startup. What we were going to go do is basically bring all that onto the internet. So the vision was something like, imagine you go online and you book a restaurant reservation. When you book your reservation, it says, hey, would you like some calamari and a pitcher of margaritas on the table when you arrive? And you know, who doesn't say yes to that? And because the consumer front end would connect to the restaurant back end, the whole thing could work seamlessly. You know, it's like 10 minutes before your reservation, the bartender starts making your drink and they start frying up your calamari. You can sit down, you can have your whole meal, you can interact with a server, you can order on your phone, kind of whatever's the right experience. And then when you're done, you just get up and walk out. And it's all billed to your Groupon account. That was the vision. And in my view, it's so sad because Groupon could have built these things that I think the world still needs to exist that no one's built yet, like the experience I just described. And they could have parlayed the traction around the coupons business into building that. And it would be at least a decabillion-dollar company today if that had happened. But instead, there were, in my view, sort of a series of missteps that all started with the company going public before it was ready. And all of that visionary stuff got shut down and the company got stuck as a internet coupon company with a very degraded brand and not a very inspiring future.
So you left 2014 and that begins this journey in the supersonic. Give us the story. What were the big hurdles to get this thing started?
Yeah, well, the tail end of my time at Groupon, they were sort of in the process of shutting down the visionary stuff I was talking about. My VP asked me to come and run a big piece of the core business. And so I was running relevance and email and a lot of what was the core of Groupon. And it was so uninspiring. You know, I was paid very well. And in my mind, I said, okay, the money I'm saving from this gets socked away in what I called the fun fund. And beyond a certain dollar amount, I was allowed to spend that money on anything I wanted. And in my head, that was the buy an airplane fund. I actually never bought the airplane, but the savings for the airplane became the seed capital for Boom. I left Groupon. I think I decompressed for a couple of weeks, but I knew I wanted to do another startup. And I thought back to everything I had learned doing the first one. And in particular, the decision to sell the company when I had a chance to. And the lesson I learned from that was that as an ambitious founder, that effort level feels the same regardless of what I'm doing. But what isn't the same is whether I'm really motivated by what I've set out to do. And, you know, I sold the first company because it was really hard and I didn't love what we were building. For my next startup, I wanted to do one where I would never get up in the morning, no matter how hard it was. I would never ask the question, why did I get myself into this? And I would always know it was worth it. And so at this point, I said, I'm going to organize all my ideas in descending order of how happy I will personally be if it works. And I'll forget everything else, whether I have the resume for it, whether it's a good idea, whether it's physically possible. And I thought I'd worked on that list, and I'll work on the most exciting thing that's not impossible. And so for me, anything with an airplane in it just goes straight to the top of that list. I'd had a Google alert on supersonic jet since my mid-20s, and I sort of set a personal lifetime goal of flying faster than the speed of sound because I never got to fly on Concorde. It shut down when I was 22. And so I thought, okay, take a deep breath. I'm sure there's a really good reason why no one's building supersonic jets, but I want to discover for myself what that is. I'll do 2 weeks of research, get it out of my system, and then I'll move on to the next idea. And you know, as luck has it, I never got off that top idea. I kept finding a whole bunch of stale conventional wisdom that didn't stand up to a fresh quantitative look at what was really possible.
So what was the group think about why no supersonic airlines anymore?
Well, I think it's an instance of something called the bystander effect. And if you don't know bystander effect, it's a term out of social science that sort of refers to this idea that if there's an emergency, someone's in trouble, and only one or two people are around, they'll tend to jump in and help. But if there are a large number of people observing some kind of a problem, everyone tends to assume everyone else has it and the right people are already on the problem. And the bizarre consequence of this is that really large, obvious things can go unaddressed for long periods of time because everybody assumes it's either impossible or the right people are already on it. I think supersonic flight was one of those. I mean, who wouldn't want a faster airplane? Literally everybody would benefit from flights that are faster and more convenient. So there was this implicit assumption that there had to be something wrong with that idea or else somebody would be doing it. And then you could go on YouTube and there were sort of plausible sounding, but not actually correct explanations. Like, one thing that was said was you have to solve the sonic boom problem in order to find a market. Another was that when supersonic came back, it would have to be a private jet for the ultra wealthy, not an airliner. Another was that it would inherently cost more and that people wouldn't pay more. And it turns out none of that is true. None of it stands up to a relatively simple first order analysis that I could do with a spreadsheet and data that I found in Wikipedia. And one of the lessons I learned from that experience is never accept a qualitative answer to a quantitative question. And so there were all these qualitative explanations of why supersonic flight wasn't commercially viable. But really, it's a question of how fast is the airplane and what routes would it fly on? What would the fares have to be for it to be profitable? And how many people could afford to fly on those routes and how much demand is there? And what's it going to cost to develop? And, it's numbers that really say it doesn't make any sense. And so there were all this sort of qualitative dismissal that didn't stand up to running the math. The reality was that Boom could have been founded probably 10 or 15 years before it actually was. But nobody looked. Nobody ran the math.
So why didn't Boeing do this?
Oh, that's a fascinating question. Boeing certainly could do this. In fact, they invented the key technology for it. All of the key enabling technology for mainstream commercial supersonics really debuted on the 787 Dreamliner that Boeing built. Technologically, they're capable of this, but it's a classic innovator's dilemma situation. So the pace of innovation on subsonic aircraft, it has become so, subsonic, that when Boeing, or same thing's true at Airbus, when they develop a new airplane, they invest billions of dollars to build a relative commodity that's a low-margin product that they're going to have to keep in production for decades to come in order to earn back their investment. And so the last thing that a big company wants to do is come out with a new product that's going to cannibalize sales of the existing product before they've earned back their investment. And so if Boeing did what we're doing, it would suck the most profitable passengers out of the front of the 787s before they earn back their 787 investment. And so if you look at what their product development really is, they're focused on building replacement cycle products, not cannibalization cycle products. And so technologically, could they do it? Yeah, absolutely. I think we can do it faster and better as a focused startup, but they could absolutely do it. But they don't have the business motivation to do it. because it would cannibalize the cash cows.
So you're building this fascinating startup. You've got a prototype in place, the XB1. I think you're going to fly the plane, your first plane in this 2026. What I'm interested in is you've been hiring these people to share this dream with you, to go on this journey. I read somewhere about your favorite interview question. Could you tell us what it is?
Yeah. So to put this in context, you know, as we were saying before, I'm a software engineer by training. And on day zero at Boom, my only knowledge of airplanes was how to fly a very little one. I knew I would need to learn a lot, and I would need to learn to hire people who knew a lot more than I did about their domains. And so what I found was I could ask people to teach me something. And it was shockingly easy to discover whether people really knew what they were talking about. Because I could just walk away from that interview and say, do I understand it or not? And what I found was most people operate on rules of thumb, not real deep understanding. And if you're doing something that's been done over and over again, rules of thumb work. But if you're going to break from tradition, you have to operate from first principles. What's physically possible? What's financially viable? Knowing a rule of thumb doesn't cut it. And so in asking people, teach me something, and then kind of iterating with them in the conversation to see whether I could really get my head around it, I could separate out the people who are first principles thinkers from the people who only had rules of thumb. And the result was we were able to build a culture of people who were first principles thinkers and great communicators.
So you have done, for a startup, sort of amazing work. You got a $2 billion pre-order from Virgin for 10 aircraft by 2016. By the way, in 2015, you'd only raised $700,000. And you went on to get an order from the U.S. Air Force, American Airlines, United Airlines. Tell me how on earth you did that.
One step at a time. And so, yeah, to recap where we are today, there's an order from American and United, and a pre-order from Japan Airlines. We say order when we mean there's a non-refundable deposit that's in place, and a pre-order is kind of more like an option. Maybe the story of the United deal is kind of the best one to tell here. So this was this came together starting late 2020, kind of going into 2021. We announced the United order in the summer of 21. And the way it got started was we were actually out raising a round of capital. And I was talking with an investor, and he had been doing kind of due diligence checks on Boom, calling people he knew in the industry and asking what they thought. And he calls me up and he says, Blake, I'm going to invest, but I'm also going to introduce you to this guy at United who does not think what you're doing makes a whole lot of sense. See if you can convince him to just not be a detractor. And so I was like, okay. And I took the intro, and it was sort of the mission of neutralize the detractor. And the conversation started with a focus on sustainability. It said something like, you know, look, I love what you're doing here, but at United, we really value sustainability. And so obviously we would never do this. And, you know, I explained that sustainability was actually one of the best reasons to do supersonic, because we were designing Overture, you know, from the ground up to be compatible with 100% sustainable aviation fuel. And it could actually be the first airplane in their fleet that would operate on net zero carbon. So from that conversation, everything sort of leapt forward, and it was just a little bit more than 6 months from the very first conversation with United to being able to announce their order of jets. It started with trying to neutralize a detractor, and then ultimately turned into our anchor customer for Overture.
Well, let's unpack some of your career and life lessons. You were at Amazon before Amazon, truthfully, was really Amazon. You were at a few tech startups after that, as we talked about, and then Groupon. You even had your own startup in high school. What kind of mindset is necessary to lead a successful startup?
Working on something I care about, that I want to create in the world, has been, I think, the most important things. If I look back at the biggest successes I've had, it was when I took on things that I really wanted to work, that I wanted to create, and where I was willing to put aside my fears of whether I would succeed or not, and just run at the problem. Boom is a good case study in that, you know, on day zero, like, I didn't have the resume to build an aviation company, let alone a supersonic jet company. And it was kind of a heady thing to go do, because I knew either we would fail or we would do something that really would change the world. There wasn't a whole lot of in between. And I struggled with that for a while and ultimately decided that, you know, the people who take on big missions and succeed, we know their names. That's the Wright brothers. That's Bill Gates. That's Steve Jobs, etc. And the ones who try and they don't succeed, we don't know their names. They're lost to history. But they know they gave it their all. And the thing I told myself in 2014 was the only way to know what I could do would be to give it a try. And I wanted to pick a mission where I would rather try and fail than not try, period.
So most companies starting out, culture becomes really important. It's really the glue. Some people call it the operating system that binds everything together. Core values I've observed that really seem to be essential are urgency, focus, and curiosity. How do those three work together for you?
Urgency, focus, and curiosity. I mean, those are three really important values. Thinking about how those play out at Boom, we've challenged ourselves to do quickly something that a lot of people say you can't do at all. And, you know, how quickly can we get to hardware? How quickly can we learn something? You know, can we go sell an airplane before we've ever even built one yet? Focus is like the secret weapon of a startup. Like what we were talking about earlier with Boeing and why Boeing's not doing supersonic, you know, they have the problem of an established business that they don't want to disrupt. And one of the biggest luxuries and benefits of a startup is you exist in the world for one purpose. We're here to make supersonic flight a reality and make it mainstream. And that luxury of focus enables us to put our brains and our best people on the things that matter most. And then last but not least, necessity of learning. And I think curiosity and first principles thinking really go together. Why do things work the way they do today? What would be possible if things were different? What could we change? But also that a mindset of being willing to be wrong and to change our minds quickly really matters. One of my sayings is that if you want to be right a lot, one of the best things to do is to stop being wrong quickly. And so that requires listening to reality, listening to evidence, listening to people around us. And when we discover that our previous view or previous strategy was wrong, that's not something to be ashamed of. That's something to be excited about. That's called learning. One of the things that I'm working really hard to make part of the Boom culture is that it's okay to change your mind, because changing your mind is called learning.
What do you say when people say it won't work? You just gave us an example of United. Tell me a little bit more about how you use that culturally in your company.
But there are plenty of skeptics, and they have good reason. It's been more than a century since the last entrepreneurially founded commercial aircraft company, which was Douglas Aircraft in 1921. And, you know, they got to start with a single engine propeller plane. And, you know, we're saying we're going to build a transoceanic supersonic passenger airplane as a new company. So there's plenty of challenge. But the thing that gives me heart is, on one hand, this absolutely should exist. You know, it's hard to imagine, say, in 2050, 2060, that we're still flying subsonic. It needs to come. It's inevitable. And it really needs to come from a new entrant. And so we say, great, what would a successful attempt at this have to look like? You know, it's going to require an ambitious team. It's going to require really talented individuals. It's going to require an ability to be persuasive of customers, of investors, of suppliers. It's going to require deep passion for mission and deep belief, because the journey will be long and hard, and persevering through it is going to be necessary for success. There are plenty of big challenges ahead of us, but also some that are in the rearview mirror. We've built and tested history's first independently developed supersonic jet. We've pre-sold $26 billion in Overture airplanes in orders and pre-orders. North Carolina has contributed $200 million to the project and is funding build out of the Overture Superfactory in Greensboro. And so there are plenty of quote-unquote impossible things left to do, but I look backwards and we've already done some things that everybody said we couldn't do.
You're the founder and CEO of Boom Supersonic, but you're also a human with a family. How do you integrate those two?
It's challenging. And some of the worst moments personally are when I feel like I really need to be in two places at the same time, and I just have to choose. I try to make it win-win as much as I can. And you know, just to give one story, earlier this year, I got to personally fly supersonic for the first time on a T-38 along with our chief test pilot down in the Mojave Desert. And so I flew myself down to Mojave, you know, in the Cirrus, and brought my kids along for it. We made it into like a little bit of a family vacation. They got to have an experience flying with me. And you know, we got to have a lot of conversations, you know, afterwards about you know, how I've chosen what I work on. And you know, I hope it will inspire them to go off and do things that they love that will be meaningful to them. So that's one of the better stories.
So let's move to some advice. What's the best advice you've ever received?
I've been lucky to have a lot of good pieces of advice. If I think about the ones that have been most pivotal, you know, for the success I've had, a lot of it comes down to people encouraging me to believe in myself when I wasn't sure. It's so easy for me to have self-doubt and to say, okay, what can I do? Am I going to succeed at this? Should I try something easier? Should I expect that someone better than I am, you know, can go off and do these things? And I've been lucky to have, you know, some friends and mentors at critical junctures when I wasn't sure who said, no, I think you can do this. You should definitely give it a try. That helped give me the courage to be more bold.
So if you could, what advice would you give your 21-year-old self?
Aim high, stay curious. Whenever you face a choice between doing something easier and doing something harder, do the harder thing so long as it's something that you're passionate about. And don't spend your time on missions you don't love.
So we end each episode of Math and Magic with a shout out to heroes, influencers, and mentors. In business, I think it is the combination of the math and the magic that leads to success. Analytical understanding, the math part, and the sheer creativity built on that understanding that excites consumers, builds the fantastic products. You get two shout outs, one for the math person and one for the creative. Who are they?
On the math side, it's Jeff Bezos. And on the creative side, it is Steve Jobs, who showed that we could build products that people would fall in love with.
Blake, thanks so much for letting me go deep into airplanes and indulging my inner plane geek. And thanks for bringing supersonic travel back for us non-military types. We wish you the best. And I hope you'll let me come fly your sim sometime. And congrats on all your success.
Thank you, Bob. Yeah, looking forward to doing some hangar flying together.
Here are a few things I picked up in my conversation with Blake. One, do what you love. At Boom, Blake is creating what many thought was impossible because of his lifelong interest in aviation. He's proof that if you follow your passion and you're willing to reinvent yourself, you'll succeed. As Blake said, skills are variable, passion is not. Two, know what you don't know. Learning new skills are essential parts of building a business. Don't worry if your ideas keep changing. As Blake says, that's not a sign of chaos. It's a sign that you're getting closer to the right answer. Three, never accept a qualitative answer to a quantitative question. As Blake explains, if he listened to all the qualitative explanations about why supersonic flight wasn't commercially viable, Boom wouldn't exist. I'm Bob Pittman. Thanks for listening.
That's it for today's episode. Thanks so much for listening to Math and Magic, a production of iHeartRadio. The show is hosted by Bob Pittman. Special thanks to Sydney Rosenblum for booking and wrangling our wonderful talent, which is no small feat. Our editor, Emily Marinoff. Our engineer, Jessica Kranchich. Our executive producers, Nikki Itor and Ali Perry. And of course, Gail, Raul, Eric, Angel, Noel, and everyone who helped bring this show to your ears. Until next time.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, is finally here.
With the first pick in the NFL Draft.
Catch all 7 rounds, 3 days, live from Detroit.
They're looking to get a guy that they believe can change the game.
With NFL Network Draft coverage presented by Verizon and on ABC, ESPN, ESPN Deportes, and streaming on NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/draft for more information. Rocket Mortgage, official partner of the NFL Draft.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.